Viewers, listeners, welcome to another episode of Blighty Talks Bricks. My guest today is someone that I don't actually personally know, and we've literally met in the last few minutes. That said, I have seen him speak on many occasions. He's a guy that's been around the industry a little bit longer than me, so that takes some doing. He came into the property industry, well, construction industry, in 1983, back at Crest Nicholson. He's been a board member of the HBF since 2002, and he's been in the role of executive chairman from 2006 to 2024. He's now the current chairman of the HBF. He has numerous other roles. He's a really interesting guy. I'm really excited to have this time and have a chat to him. So I'd just like to welcome Stuart. Welcome to Blighty Talks Bricks. How are you?
I'm good. Lovely to be here. Great to see you and meet you at last.
Well, As I said, I've seen you speak a number of times.
I apologise about that.
No. Listen, seriously, the one thing that always comes across from people that have had a long career in the industry, they're passionate about it. And I've seen you speak passionately about it. And I know when we had a little telephone call the other day, you spoke passionately about it. First question I always like to ask is, for obviously the viewers and listeners, this podcast is growing in terms of the audience. How did you manage to find your way in the property industry, particularly residential development?
Yeah, well, the honest answer to that is it was just chance, just luck. I left school. I was, you know, not clear what I wanted to do. I guess that's a situation a lot of young people find themselves in. I think my father would have liked me to be a bank manager or an accountant or
That would have been back in the day the way to go, wouldn't it?
Secure job, safe, you know, job for life, good pension at the end, all that sort of thing. But I stumbled on a job in a state agency is the honest answer in the late 1970s when I was about 21, 22 years of age. And I sold houses for about 9 months. I actually got reasonably bored with that fairly quickly once I'd kind of mastered and done it. And the partner of the estate agency that I worked for, a chap called Mike Davis, still alive to this day, still in touch with him. He's went into his 80s now to this day. He asked me if I fancied doing land. To which I said, doing what with land? And he said, you know, we're creating a new homes department. The idea is we find sites for builders. They then give us the instructions to sell the homes. And so I thought, what have I got to lose? And so I started with a completely clean piece of paper. And around about 1980, 81, looking for land. And the very first person I found a piece of land for, to be more accurate, was Tony Pidgley.
Was it really?
The Barclay Group, yeah, who I met about that time and remained a lifelong friend until his sad demise.
Very sad.
3 years ago or thereabouts. But I also did some work looking for land for Crest and for Bryant in those days, who were a big developer as well. And in the 1983 or thereabouts, John Calcutt, who was then the chief exec of Crest, together with Mike Freshney.
Mike I worked with.
Roger Lewis, who was the chairman, asked me if I wanted to jump ship, so to speak, and work for them. And so I joined Crest in the summer of 83 and started looking for land for them and helped them grow a division. They had a division in Weybridge, which I think it's fair to say, with the benefit of hindsight, they had expanded into new territories. They'd opened regional offices in Ferndown, in Westrum, and in North London, and probably slightly neglected their home base, because Crest was founded in the 1960s in Walton-on-Thames, just down the road. And so they had a bit of a challenge in terms of, you know, growing land in that particular area. So I started as land and sales manager. I think we had not very many plots when I started, but within a few years we had grown it to be the largest division in Crest. We had a little bit of luck, as you do, as you need a bit
you
of
make
luck.
Your own luck, don't you?
Yeah, well, you make your own luck, but also this was the Thatcher government era, so the early 80s were quite tough.
I remember them.
Some pretty tough financial measures, VAT being increased, other austerity measures, but then gradually things improved as the 80s rolled on, and house prices, there was a bit more inflation in house prices, partly because there was more inflation in the economy.
Yep.
And we also found some great sites in southwest London and in Surrey. And within about 4 or 5 years, we were, I think, the largest division in Crest or thereabouts. And I had risen through the ranks to be sort of the deputy to the managing director in that division.
Okay.
When I got headhunted by Charles Church and ended up at Charles Church, and 2 years later ended up as CEO of Charles Church.
So you mentioned Charles Church, and I know that you've worked for a number of companies over the years, and I don't want to take you too far away from the conversation about the HBF, but what was your most enjoyable time in the industry?
Oh, I've had many, because the honest answer is that I am passionate about this industry, and I think I realised very, very early on that I, by luck, stumbled into an industry and a job that I really loved. And that's, you know, it's very important. I mean, I think people are always more successful
if you enjoy
when they really enjoy what they're doing. So the Crest years were very much the formative years. It's where I learned how to run a house building business, in essence. Mike Freshney in particular had the most fantastic systems and standards established at Crest, which, you know, have lived with me ever since in everything.
Yeah, they were good at lots of things, weren't they?
Yeah. Charles Church had flair and imagination and design and an eye for detail that, you know, many other developers didn't have. That's probably what distinguished Charles Church in that particular period, was his love of certain house types, which sort of live on to this day. And so I, you know, very quickly embraced that philosophy and married it with the disciplines that I'd brought from Crest Haynes. And when, sadly, Charles died in a plane crash, Spitfire, he was flying in July 89, a few months after that, I got asked to become chief executive of Charles Church at probably one of the most difficult periods in housing history.
Yeah. It was a tough time at that.
The 1989 to 1992 period, I think, you know, of all the recessionary cycles I've worked through, that still, I think, is the toughest I've seen, including the financial crash of the late 2000s, including the period we've been through in the last couple of years. And it was very challenging. You know, I had to do things that I never dreamed I would have to do, shrinking the size of the organization, making a lot of people redundant, cutting our cloth effectively, restructuring the debt of the business.
It's difficult, isn't it? I mean, we've gone through it ourselves recently. It's difficult.
Well, it's very difficult when you don't know what you're doing. When you start from a position that, as I did, where I felt that I understood buying land, building houses and selling them, and I pretty much understood the development process, to then find yourself in the hot seat as the CEO of a business, and particularly as the CEO of a business that's in a little bit of financial distress, and it wasn't alone in that sense, but, you know, and having to navigate debt restructurings at around 31, 32 years of age with no experience of it, is a rapid learning curve. And that's where I discovered that not only did I have a love for the house building business, but I also had it may sound big-headed, I don't mean it to sound big-headed, but I had an ability to actually...
You could deal with it. Some people can't deal with certain challenges.
Yeah, but and the biggest challenge was taking people on the journey. And I guess the thing that I did there that I really learned about was how to motivate people in the most difficult circumstances. Because when, you know, 350 people is cut to 50 people, the other 50 people are naturally very nervous as to when their
confidence goes.
Exactly.
They're nervous looking over their shoulder.
Exactly, and you have to take them through that process and make them believe there is a future. And you clearly have to do that in an honourable way with integrity. In other words, you can't lie to people or make things up. So people ask me straightforwardly, have I got a job for life? The answer is no one's got a job for life. You know, are we still going to be here in 2 years' time? I don't know. I hope so. And here's what I'm doing to make sure we are. But I found actually that honesty and being generally upfront with people was a very good approach. And that people did want to get behind the collective mission, if you will, to restore the finances of the business and put it back into good shape.
So by the sounds of it, it wasn't an enjoyable time, but it's obviously the first thing that comes to your mind when I ask you that question, because there will be scars there.
Well, I think
how you dealt with it.
I think it defined me. I think in truth it defined me. I could have been sitting here today as the guy who sat in the hot seat at Charles Church in 1990, 1991, with you saying, you're the guy in the hot seat at Charles Church when it went under, weren't you? And that would have potentially defined me, as opposed to I was the guy who potentially helped to turn it around and then subsequently executed a successful sale of the business to Beazer a few years later. And consequently, I then went on the Beazer board, which was then a top three home builder, and then, you know, joined up with a big American company and bought Fairclough and joined HBF. And the rest is kind of history in that sense. But it may have been a very different history had that not worked out at Charles Church.
We've mentioned already in this podcast the word passion. And I said, I felt you had that. And even today, and that's obviously what steered you through that time, and you still remember it.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think that's a mark of a good business person.
Yeah.
And that takes you forward. Is the housing world, in this modern world, are we in a better place today?
Oh, gosh, that's a really complex question. I think we are producing much better quality products. I think what we do is much more professional. And I think the businesses are very well run by professional management teams, which I think is a giant step forward in lots of ways. And that's not to be critical of people from a different era, but as the industry has evolved, it's gone from owner drivers into a more professional management structure. And I think that does help in terms of navigating cycles economically and in other areas. On the other side of the coin, it's a much more complex business today than it was when I joined Crest in 1983. I think if somebody had been put into a coma in 1983 and reawakened in
today
and beamed into the boardroom of Crest or indeed any other home building business, they would very quickly get lost. They wouldn't even understand the language that's being discussed around the boardroom table. And I think the business is much more regulated and much more complicated, and really much more difficult for small and medium-sized companies to either get established, or if they do manage to get established, really tough for them to grow. So I think it's evolved, and there are some things in the way it's evolved which are naturally good and better, and there are some things which, you know, the barriers to entry are certainly much greater than they were back in that time. Can you imagine Tony Pidgley or Steve Morgan doing today what they achieved in that period?
I know, and I think you make a great answer to the question. And I know for a fact that I couldn't start my worry is that I couldn't start my business today. And I talk to lots of people in different businesses, and they all say the same, you know. And if I just think about that, I'm not particularly intelligent. If I just think about that and think, if people are not starting up businesses and are scared to grow businesses, which is definitely a fear factor today, that surely that must lead to more unemployment, is the way I perceive it. And that might not be right, but I think it's a good answer. One of the things that you have to do on the HBF, you've in your time, you would have had Labour government, you would have had a Conservative government, we have a Labour government now. Two questions, really. One, we always perceive that Labour and Conservative are different in their views to property. That must make the HBF role difficult, because you go along for a period of time, minimum 4 years in most cases, then it might be a bit longer. Do you have to change your narrative? That, you know, when you went to bed and it was Conservative, you woke up and Labour. Do you have to then actually say, right, well, my role here has changed because I'm dealing with a different set of rules already? And does that mean, the second question, does that mean you have to rip up your piece of paper that you've been running for the previous, as it would have been in the Conservatives' case, 14 years?
The answer to that is no, not really. It doesn't really work like that. So if I wind the clock all the way back to when I got involved in HBF partly because I was pretty disillusioned with HBF, in truth, in the 2000s. I didn't particularly feel that HBF was representative of developers like me. I didn't think it was necessarily making the right points.
Yep.
And I didn't think it was influencing government in the right way. And that's why I got involved, to seek to influence things. You know, it's easy standing outside the tent.
Shouting and screaming.
Yeah, exactly. So it seemed fair to me that if I felt like that, I should try to change things from within, which actually, you know, in order to do that, I needed to understand it, because the thing you very quickly learn about an organization like HBF when you get involved with it, like many organizations, is the view you have from the external setting is very different to the one you get when you're inside the tent.
Yep.
And the problem, one of the problems HBF had when I first arrived was that the then Labour government just weren't engaging with us. So, you know, our ability to influence was limited. You can't influence people.
They're not going to listen.
Now, one of the reasons they weren't listening was because we'd been overtly critical in the preceding decade or so.
Nobody likes criticism, do they?
Well, you can take it for a while, and you can take it if it's constructive. But if somebody keeps telling you you're wrong, there's a point at which you say, well, I'm just not going to talk to you anymore because, you know, I'm just going to go around you. And I think that's what had happened if I was being critical, which I didn't particularly want to be because I don't think it's constructive. But, I mean, I think that's pretty much what I inherited. So, you know, when I arrived in 2006, Yvette Cooper was the housing minister, and I spent quite some time just persuading her to even see me.
Really?
That's very different to today, where we're very much on the radar screens a long way in advance. And we were going through a difficult political period because this was the tail end of the Blair administration and the handover, which wasn't that easy, as you'll recall, to the Brown administration. But there were a couple of things that happened which I was able to use to persuade the government, as it happened, a Labour government, that we were a serious organization that they should take note of, and we wanted to be part of the solutions to problems as opposed to being critical of the problems. Yep. And so I changed tack. I changed the way HBF approached things. So when government came up with an idea, rather than saying it's a crazy idea and we can't do it, which was the historic approach,
the way we dealt with it in the past, yep.
I would say it's a really interesting idea. Let me take it away and see if I can make it better. Let me take it away and see if I can analyze it and come back with some thoughts as to how this could be a win-win, how you'll get what you want politically and we'll be able to manage it and implement it. You know, if you're building on a housing site in Yorkshire or wherever, yep. You know, what's this actually going to mean? So one of the things that I didn't really realize then, but I've realized subsequently, and I think other people have said this, is that I was the first person in the hot seat at HBF who'd ever built a house or run a house building business. And thus I could speak the language of the house building industry and translate that in, and I quickly learned the language of the political industry.
It's a different narrative, isn't it?
It's a totally different narrative. So I could take the point of view of a house builder, take it on board, and then turn it into a language that actually a politician might understand. I could then take the politicians, you know, I learned the skill of how to interpret what the politicians meant and explain it to the housebuilding industry in a way they could understand. And there were two things I latched onto which I think changed the narrative with the government. The first was I introduced the customer satisfaction survey,
yep.
Which I was very familiar with from my time working in America. And the J.D. Power surveys that are done in the States, which are incredibly powerful. And if you're not a top three home builder in the sort of 50 big metropolitan areas in America, you know, you're in trouble.
Yep.
So I introduced that survey, which, the HBF five-star rating, as it's known, it's a star rating survey. Yep. It's not perfect. No survey is perfect. But I think, we had one five-star builder when I introduced it. Now we have about 35, 40 five-star builders. So I think it has helped drive up standards because everybody wants to be a five-star builder now. And indeed, public companies, when they report their numbers to the city, will talk about the fact they're a HBF five-star builder. But I think the government saw it as an industry that wanted to improve. Was prepared to actually publish a set of statistics as to what the consumers buying their homes thought of the homes they were buying and the service they'd had and the companies they'd dealt with. Would you recommend your builder to a best friend was the key question. And if the answer to that was yes, and you had to get more than 90% yes to get five stars, then that said something about you. The second thing that I latched onto and was a classic example of, let me take that away and see if we can turn that into something that we can, you know, work with, was the concept of zero carbon housing, which Gordon Brown and Yvette Cooper wanted to introduce in 2006, and being candid, I don't think anybody understood in 2006 what a zero carbon house was. I think it was an interesting concept, making things more energy efficient, but quite how you do that is the key question. And we did take that away, and we went back and said, okay, we can do something here, but we need time. We need 10 years to get this done. It needs to be done in stages. There needs to be benchmarks where, you know, points of measurement along the route. say at 3 and 6 or 7 years to achieve what we want to achieve by 2016. And so the Zero Carbon 2016, you know, program was launched jointly by the industry and by the government, and we established a task force and we established a kind of holding body to help conduct research projects and make things.
And all of that time that you're doing that, you're getting a foothold in with government,
yeah,
which we didn't have before.
No. But also having to take some slightly more reluctant than others home builders on a journey back to what I learned, you know, back with how do you motivate people and get them to do things when they don't necessarily want to do them or are not certain about it, et cetera, et cetera. So the whole thing was a process of bringing together everybody under the tent and unifying them around a common cause. Yep. And, you know, we've used exactly the same approach with the Road to Net Zero that we're on now for the Future Homes Standard in 2025, when we established the Future Homes Hub 3 or 4 years ago to achieve that. But I'm not saying those two things in isolation, but those two things, the customer satisfaction survey and the zero carbon agenda, helped get a seat at the table. And what I articulated to the industry consistently was, if I have a seat at the table, just as I'm sitting down talking to you, I have a chance of putting a point of view across.
Absolutely.
And taking, you know, getting people to understand our point of view. If they're not talking to me,
you've got no chance.
We are simply going to get whatever they impose on us. And you have to bear in mind, in 2006, and you'll probably remember this, the green agenda was rising rapidly up the political agenda. David Cameron was off riding with Huskers in the North Pole.
You know,
it was the
vote
blue, go green Tory mantra. The Lib Dems obviously were already there. Labour were there. You were fighting if you had fought against it, it was like fighting against a tidal wave. You know, you just got swallowed by it. So you had to make it work in a practical way. But it did change the narrative. And then we started to get very close to the Conservative Party in opposition. And Michael Gove was the shadow housing minister.
I'm biting my lip when you say that name.
I know you are. And I do it deliberately. because I want to make the point, I suppose, that actually he was incredibly helpful to us in that period when he was the shadow housing minister. And I formed a relationship with him, which has survived all the troubled times of the last...
Send him my love.
2 or 3 years. Yeah, of course. There was an issue at the time in the Thames Valley and running down to the New Forest with ground nesting birds, Dartford warblers and things, which led to a paralysis on house building through Surrey and Hampshire right down into the New Forest. And Michael actually helped broker the solution with the Labour government, which was the creation of, you know, special protection areas and offsetting measures to enable house building to go ahead in those areas. But as a consequence of that, we developed a relationship with the Conservative Party, which helped us.
Yep.
because we were able to help them formulate policies whilst in opposition. So they were already thinking about what their policies would be should they win the 2010 election. And so Grant Shapps actually succeeded Michael Gove as Shadow Housing Secretary, and he was in that role in the shadow or in actual position for some years, which definitely helps when you have ministers who are around for a while. And so the template for what became the MPPF in 2012, that was actually, the gestation for that was actually, the genesis of that was back in the days when they were in opposition, the concept of having local plans and checks and balances and giving more power to local authorities, but with penalties if they didn't actually perform.
Yep.
So consequently, when when Cameron formed the coalition government in 2010, it was relatively seamless from our perspective.
Yep.
Because although, you know, the government changed on that day or over those several days, because it took a few days to resolve that one, you know, it was very much business as usual for us, because Grant Shapps carried on became the housing minister as opposed to the shadow housing minister, and we very much carried on working with him on the areas we've been working with him on in opposition. And in that 18 months or so in the lead up to the election, we've been able to, you know, work collectively to dispel some of the things that would have made their planning policies not as attractive as they ended up being.
In terms of, and then obviously I take on board all of the points you've made, and we now sit at the table. Are we already sitting there with the new Labour government?
Oh, absolutely. So the same process then evolved. Right, so we enjoy very constructive relationships with the Cameron government the coalition government between 2010 and 2015. It was in that period that the MPPF came in 2012, Help to Buy came in 2013. They had some really committed housing ministers, not just Grant, but Brandon Lewis in particular was absolutely excellent when he was a housing minister. Greg Clark as the Secretary of State, the same. And we began, Labour were very much in the wilderness in this period, but it's never been my policy to not talk to people.
Yep.
And even now, I'm now talking to Conservatives, even though they are years away from being in power, probably, because you just never know. And in the same way, I've always talked to Labour.
That's some passion, isn't it?
Yeah, but also, Yvette Cooper and then subsequently John Healey, and I see John from time to time. I mean, John's really passionate about housing. I know he's now doing defence, and it's not his subject matter anymore, but if he was sitting there and you started chatting to him about housing...
He's passionate about it.
You could fill half an hour with John Healey on housing quite easily, because he is passionate about it. So we always kept in touch. Even if it was just a cup of tea twice a year or whatever, we always kept in touch. And consequently, when Labour became a serious opposition, when Keir Starmer became leader after the 2019 election, and particularly when it became apparent that the Conservative Party was in trouble in government and the likelihood of a change in government, change of party in power was more probable than not, we began to really work hard with Labour in opposition on helping them understand the challenges, understand the frustrations, understand the issues, understand what needs to be done in order to achieve their objective of building 1.5 million homes in this parliament. And Matthew Pennycook, who's been the shadow housing minister since December 2021, so again, has the benefit of having a long lead-in, learning about the subject whilst in opposition, probably the most knowledgeable politician I've ever met on planning.
That's a statement.
Really knowledgeable on planning. Could have a serious conversation with a serious planner and understands probably planning much better than I do, and I think I understand it reasonably well. So again, when the the baton was passed on July the 4th this year, for us it was a relatively seamless transition because we were already
doing underground work, so to speak.
Well, not even underground.
But you're having conversations.
It's all very open. And we've had a lot of meetings, not just with the shadow housing team, but also with the shadow business team and the shadow treasury team. I'd had a chance to chat to Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves. I mean, these were all things that happened over the last couple of years because they were very interested in housing from a very early stage. Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves, I think, recognized that they're betting the farm to some extent on delivering economic growth. Now, you may question some of that after the budget last week, but if you go back to where we were
in July,
at the time of the election, they wanted to see this country have the fastest rate of economic growth of any G7 country by the time they come to the next election. So how do you achieve that against the backdrop of the economic issues that they are inheriting, this massive pile of debt that they've got to deal with? The economy is not exactly racing ahead at the moment. And they recognize, just as I think many governments have done, if you go back to the 1930s and the post-Great Crash era, Britain built its way out of that financial difficulty. Same after the Second World War, Harold Macmillan's build, etc., etc. And to some extent, even in the 2010s, if you look at what the coalition government did to coming out of the great financial crash, we doubled output between 2012 and 2020, and obviously that generates a lot of jobs and a lot of GDP.
Yeah,
We think every 100,000 homes generates at least 1% GDP, maybe more, because, as you know, this industry is very difficult to work out exactly how deep our tentacles go into the economy.
Absolutely.
Because of the indirect benefits that come from people moving house, whatever that might be. So I think, you know, Rachel Rees and her team very quickly worked out that one way, the quickest way to grow the economy was to have ambitious housing and planning targets and then deliver them. And it's no coincidence that the very first major pronouncement this government made on the Monday after the election, effectively the first full working day of the new government, was Rachel Reeves in Treasury at 10 a.m. on Monday morning announcing changes to the planning system. Because that's front and center of what they need to do. And the reason, you know, we've spent the last 18 months explaining to them what levers they can pull, what written ministerial statements, what kind of the power of the ministerial word, if you will help drive different behaviours in local authorities where behaviours need to change, in those local authorities where they need to change if we're ever going to get proper five-year plans in place across the country and stand any chance of delivering 300,000 homes a year.
Well, there's two things here. The first thing, you make me feel a bit happier than I have felt, because I do worry about this country, particularly about what I consider to be a housing crisis. Secondly, I have a magic wand. I'm just going to give it to you for a few minutes. You've obviously been having lots of conversations, not just over the last 20 odd years, but in recent weeks and months.
Yeah.
What three things, if you was in charge, if you got the phone call from Sir Keir and he said, Stuart, just give me three things that I can crack on with tomorrow to help solve the housing crisis. What three things would you say, Prime Minister, this is what I suggest?
Three things, gosh. So I think the first is, if we're ever going to stand any chance of building 1.5 million homes over 5 years, 300,000 homes a year, it's so far away from where we're at. It doesn't really matter too much. But I think it's right to have ambitious targets.
Yep.
You stand some chance of getting closer to the goal if you set an ambitious goal, it seems to me. But to stand any chance of that being delivered, first of all, they have got to make sure those local plans are produced. If we're still here in 5 years, 5 years' time with only 25 to 30% of the country having a local plan, then, you know, that sparks failure. But secondly, they've got to avoid falling into the trap of thinking they've waved that wand and, you know, they're changing the MPPF. They've told everybody that, sent the signal, read, smell the coffee, wake up, etc. This is what's coming, get on with it. Don't fall into the trap of thinking it's job done, because it's only job started. It's not just about high-level strategic land release, which this will potentially produce if local plans get produced and identify, you know, 300,000 plots a year. Great. You then need to really get to grips with the development process. And it just, you know, I'm sure you hear this everywhere you go from everybody you talk to. And of course, it's not just housing. It's in every sector of the economy. Everybody I meet in any business moans about the planning system. And it's slow and it's treacle-like and it takes forever.
Yep.
And we've got to speed that up. We cannot have a situation where the simplest applications, and in our case housing applications, for 10, 20, 30 houses cost over £100,000 and take 18 months to 2 years to actually just get, you know, a stamp that enables someone to go and start digging in the ground. That's got to be speeded up. Secondly, there is huge swathes of the country which are affected by nutrient neutrality. And, you know, it's a complex issue and there are clearly challenges with our waterways. And but most of those challenges are caused by either slurry coming off farms or by wastewater treatment plants that have not been adequately upgraded.
Yep.
New homes actually contribute less than 1% of the problem. But the solution appears to be to stop building. So there are currently 160,000 homes with planning permission not started in 74 districts across England and Wales.
Wow.
If you want to wave a magic wand and see some building action in a hurry,
yep,
find a way through that the environmental groups can live with. You know, clearly the long-term solutions are improving the wastewater treatment plants and not having so much slurry going off farms. But it's kind of crazy to me that big developers, but others, big developers in particular, are going around buying farms and closing them down just to improve the quality of the water courses to enable homes to be built in those areas at a time when there's a world food crisis.
Yep.
You know, square that circle and explain that to me as being a sensible thing to do logically. And the third thing is, we do have a housing crisis, and you know, the housing crisis is apparent across a range of areas. There are far too many children in homeless accommodation. There are far too many people on housing waiting lists. There is a crisis in affordable housing. And housing associations are really struggling at present. They're struggling for a whole variety of reasons. And again, these issues are multifaceted and very complex. But put very simply, you know, if I was trying to explain this to somebody over a pint in a pub, they've had their cost base squeeze. Yeah, their costs have gone up. Their income hasn't, so they've had a squeeze, if you would, on their free cash from that point of view. They're having to deal with cladding issues, but they're also having to deal with remediation issues generally after the terrible death of that child in the Northwest. I think it was in Rochdale, the three-year-old boy who died. So quite understandably, they're reluctant to earmark capital to Section 106 agreement, or indeed development full stop, when they've got so many other issues to earmark cash for. And as a consequence, there are today, we think 25,000-30,000, we can't be sure. We did a straw poll amongst some large house builders, there are planning permissions with, you know, 20-30% of the homes that are going to be built being allocated under a Section 106 agreement for social housing, where there's no takers for the social housing.
Yeah, I've heard it on numerous occasions.
And as a consequence of that, the private development is not being done either, because the planning permission demands...
Back to the drawing board in lots of cases.
So we think there's 25,000-30,000 social homes that could be built tomorrow, or a great many of them could be built tomorrow, that are currently frustrated because there's no buyer for those social homes. Now, you know, it is complex, and I'm certainly not in the blame game at all, but what I think government needs to do, if it's waving a magic wand, is get to grips, not just with how you get more land out of the system, but how you process that land through the system and how you unlock consents that are already there.
Where all the hard, lots of hard work has
Correct.
Been done
but
to
where
get
either,
the consent.
For either nutrients or... in the case of social housing, restrictive funding of housing associations is preventing those homes, and particularly the social homes, which are desperately needed for those families on housing waiting lists.
Yep.
So that you know, there's a myriad of other things beyond that. But if they tackled those things, it would make an almighty difference in a very quick space of time.
Well, you've explained them very well. They're all points that I understand. They are points that I hear just go around, as you say, not just people in the property world. Hopefully the government will grab... It's a bit of a nettle at the moment, isn't it? And there's lots of nettles that they've got to look at.
Absolutely.
I want to move on to some good things. I know that you're a patron with a charity, Children with Special Needs.
Yeah.
We as the construction industry, do lots for charity. That's another thing that concerns me. How's that charity going?
It's great. It's actually a very small local charity. It was founded in 1995, I think. I'm doing this from memory now. It's a long time ago. It was by the husband of my then secretary when I was running Charles Church, which is how I got involved.
Yeah.
And I've been a supporter of it ever since. And my wife and I, as you say, are patrons of it. The founders are just approaching their 80th year. So they did tell me earlier this year they're actually thinking they might take a slightly more of a back step and let some other people do some heavy lifting on it. But it helps children in Surrey, where you would think you may not have that many children who need help. Not just sick children, but children from, you know, who have ambitions that can't be realised for whatever reason. And what I really like about the charity is that we have no administrative costs. Every single penny that we raise is spent on our special children.
Is it?
And, you know, in that case, in that way, it's different from larger charities, which by definition have structures and have employees and have a range of costs and overheads that they have to meet. But that's my...
Well, as I say, it does. I mean, the industry, certainly I've been to many, many charity dues, and it is sometimes quite shocking when you see things put in front of you.
Yeah, well, I'm passionate about mental health issues as well for a whole variety of other reasons, including some ones very close to home and family-wise. And I've been a big supporter of the Lighthouse charity over the last several years, and was delighted at an HBF conference 2 or 3 years ago to present them with a cheque for £150,000. We've also done a lot of work helping train first aiders within housing businesses on mental health issues, which of course is an invisible illness.
Absolutely.
And is often not understood. And we have more male suicide, sadly, in our sector, young men, than it's the highest area in the country, I believe, in terms of the rate of suicides. But we are particularly bad as a sector, and we've been doing a lot to try and help to educate people as to how to deal with those things. Because I think, if you're on a house building site and you're different in some way, whatever that might be, it can be a lonely place if you don't.
You're certain, with a number of people I've had on have talked about various challenges in the industry. And I think that's the same with all industries in its way. And it's good to talk about it.
And also we've got to get rid of some of the, I got really annoyed a few years ago, wrote a stinking letter actually to the Daily Mail, didn't publish it, but I felt better because I wrote it, because their headline was, even the building sites have gone woke, they're now playing classic FM. As if there's something kind of wrong with that.
It's a line, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's a line that, we're of an age group, particularly males, that it wasn't the right thing to talk about feeling a bit low or a bit negative or a bit different.
No, but like a lot of things, and I was very lucky in that I witnessed things when I was in my 20s and 30s, which actually, as I said earlier, helped formulate me, helped develop my character and my beliefs and my moral compass almost as to what's right or wrong. And I did see some in this industry, some people treated horrendously, not just females, but I saw some bullying on housing sites and things, and I vowed, if ever I became a chief executive of a home builder, that we would never do it, I would not tolerate any of that. And I made it very clear from a very young age that this was a, I ran a meritocracy. People could always talk to me. My door was always open. I was always happy to hear different ideas and to discuss them, and more than happy to accept that I may have got something wrong and there could be a better way of doing something. Yeah. I love nothing more than that. And some of the best ideas I've ever been given have been given from some of the most unusual places.
Yeah.
But I would not tolerate any personal abuse or bullying or harassment, sexual or otherwise, of anybody. And that's always been the mantra by which I've run every business that I've ever been lucky enough to be at the helm of.
Well, when we sat down, I said to you that we mentioned some names that we know in common, that time goes quickly.
Yeah.
It's flown. It's been an absolute pleasure for me to have you on. I've really enjoyed talking to you. As I say, I've seen you from a distance. I could sit and talk to you all day long because I think there's so many things in common. We could certainly touch on golf.
We could, yeah. You're probably a lot better than that than me.
Well, listen, everyone has a bad day, don't they?
Let's put that to the test.
Okay, well, we'll get something sorted. But, Stuart, thank you very much for your time.
Been a great pleasure.
I appreciate you're busy, and I appreciate you working hard for the industry. I'd like to thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Okay.
Viewers, listeners, Stuart, I've really enjoyed it. I said to you, I thought I was going to enjoy it. I've really enjoyed it. It's got my mind, my little tiny little mind ticking over. Lots of little questions. I'm sure that I'm going to be emailing him and asking him this and that. But I hope you've enjoyed the episode. Thanks very much for tuning in. Look forward to seeing you all soon. Take care. Stay safe. Cheers.